Okay, welcome back everyone. We're going to start again the final session. So it's my pleasure to introduce, we've got a double-headed talk this time. And the first of our two speakers is Mehdi Karamati. And Mehdi has a great and varied CV. He did his BSc in computer science, and then a master's in economics, and now has got into neuroscience and computational approaches to drug addiction, which he's going to talk about now. And also, I'll introduce in the same breath Zhaozi Gu, who you've been seeing for the last 2 days. She's also going to follow on from him. So take it away.
Thank you.
So over the next hour, I'm going to talk about some computational approaches to addiction. So I will try to be a little bit computational, not too much. So I won't have any equations, but I'll try to somehow very intuitively tell you what is the algorithmic ideas behind the models I'm going to explain to you. So as the outline of my talk, I will first tell you a very little bit about what addiction is as we know it in humans, and then very little bit about animal models of addiction, which try to capture as best as possible those aspects of addiction observed in humans. And then based on those animal models, we know a very little bit about what is happening in the brain when animals or human subjects take drugs. So given this introduction, then I will be able to talk about three different approaches to modeling drug addiction. The first one is based on brain homeostatic regulation mechanisms. The second one is based on reinforcement learning systems, which you have heard a lot about over these 2 days, I guess. And then the last one is a kind of an integrative approach, which tries to explain addiction as a unified framework, as a unified framework of homeostatic reinforcement learning system. And then the next part, the second part of the talk, will be presented by Zhaozi, which she will give a kind of broader picture of how to go beyond this simplified perspective. So addiction in humans, so this is a fairly good definition of what addiction is. So it's defined as compulsive engagement in addictive drugs. So compulsive means you keep going for drugs even when you know that it's associated with some very bad consequences, social, occupational, all sorts of consequences. And you're kind of incapable of stopping your own actions. So as some behavioral features of addiction, I can mention behavioral sensitization, meaning that every time the same dose of drug you have been using before makes you more behaviorally motivated for seeking drug than before. So you keep more and more sensitized to addiction. But in terms of pharmacology, you can observe desensitization or tolerance, meaning that the same dose of alcohol doesn't have the same desirable effect that you expect from it next time you use it. So each time you may need to increase your dose in order to get the same expected pleasure, so which is called tolerance to drug. Another feature is compulsive seeking of drug, which as I said, means seeking drug despite the fact that you are aware of the adverse consequences associated with it. Self-described mistake, meaning that at the same time that you are seeking drug, you say that, yeah, I know I'm doing wrong, but I can't stop myself. And drug dependence, which is either psychological or physical dependence, meaning that if you stop taking drug for any reason, you will have some physical or psychological effect, withdrawal effects. You'll have pain or psychological. You may feel stressed, or for some reasons you feel that in order to stop those withdrawal symptoms, you will have to go back, so you're dependent on the drug. And last but not least, relapse, meaning that after a long period of abstinence, if you're put back in a certain situation that maybe reminds you of the drug, then you relapse, and so the story begins again. So these are only some of the aspects of addiction observed in humans. So and the ideal for the neurobiological and psychological research on addiction would be if we could capture some of these effects in animals, so that we'll be able to do experimental studies under totally controlled conditions to see what is happening in the brain that results in these symptoms. So, but you should always have in mind that these symptoms are, these aspects of addiction are not equal among different drugs and among different people. So there are huge individual differences among people. Some people are more vulnerable to drugs, some people are less. And there is also a huge difference among different drugs in terms of their symptoms. So, but in this talk, I'm going to totally, in my part of the talk at least, I'm going to totally ignore these complexities and individual differences as well. And I'm going to give you a very, very simplified picture of addiction. I'll mostly focus on what are the common effects of almost all sorts of addictive drugs, and then try to come up with a very simplified model that can capture those common aspects and common neurobiological, pharmacological effects. So we're going to ignore these complexities. So I'll briefly mention two animal models that will try to capture some of those, that list of features I explained to you. The first one is drug self-administration. So in this animal model, the animal is put in a cage where one or two levers are available. One lever, let's say, results in food if you press it. The other lever, when you press it, you get some intravenous injection of cocaine or any other drug. So after some time, the animal learns to press this lever in order to get reward. And then you can test all sorts of factors, how they affect animals' behavior. For example, what will happen if every time the animal presses the lever and receives cocaine, what if I give the animal an electric shock, a kind of a strong electric shock? Does the animal keep pressing the lever? If it does, then you can claim that you're capturing compulsivity, which is observed in humans. So this electric shock is kind of capturing those catastrophic financial consequences of getting drug, for example, but addicts keep doing that. Or, for example, you can look at neural substrate, what is happening in different parts of the brain when the animal takes drug. What if, for example, you take out a certain brain area? Does the animal still show compulsive behavior? So these animal models, like other animal models, helps us to do experiment in much more controlled conditions. So one of the very seminal behavioral effects that is observed in this animal model is by Ahmed and Koop in 1998. So what they have observed is that if you have two different groups of animals, the first group, you give them access to this condition, to this lever, which results in cocaine, only 1 hour per day. The second group have access to cocaine 6 hours per day. What they observe is that in the first group, which they called short access group, only 1 hour per day, and the total number of pressing the lever over that 1 hour is fixed over time, over several days, over 12 days. It doesn't increase. But if the animal has longer access to cocaine per day, then you will see that on the first day, the animal only presses 6 times higher than this guy, because they have 6 hours, these guys have 1 hour. But over time, in contrast to these guys, they increase the rate of lever press. So they show that this is a very consistent behavioral model for cocaine addiction. And then based on this, they and lots of other labs have studied different aspects of addiction. So keep that in mind. I will come back to it when we go to computational models. Another very simple animal model that I'm sure you have heard of is condition place preference, where very similar to the previous one, You have two different contexts. If the animal is here, for example, every time the animal goes in one compartment of this small room, they will receive some drug. If they go to the other compartment, they will receive saline. And so you would want to see whether the animal gradually learns to go to the drug compartment, and what are the effects of playing with different components. Will the animal, for example, keep going if there is a punishment there, or several other effects. So, yeah, as we expect, these animal models are supposed to help us looking also at some neural substrates of the pharmacological levels of effects of addiction. So one thing that we know very well that is common among almost all sorts of addictive drugs is about their effect on dopamine system. So I'm sure you have heard a lot about dopamine over these days. This is a dopamine pathway in the human brain. And so the projections start from ventral tegmental area and substantia nigra, and they project to a striatum and also to prefrontal cortex. So, and they're, as you probably know, they're carrying a kind of teaching signal which provides you with information in order to update how much you expect to receive by doing a certain action. If I expect to get some reward and I do that and I don't get that reward, I get disappointed. I had some error in my prediction, so I use, for example, these prediction error signal in order to update, come up with a better estimate of what is the consequence of outcomes next time. So what is shown is that, for example, you see that this is a dopamine terminal, and so dopamine neurons release dopamine molecule, and then the postsynaptic neuron is receiving them. And these green guys are called dopamine transporters. So their function is to reuptake the dopamine that is released in the synaptic cleft in order to use them for when the next action potentials come. You can use the same molecules in the next run. So their function is to just clean up and use it for the later use. So what cocaine does, one among many other effects of cocaine, is that cocaine blocks these transporters. The dopamine that is released in this area cannot be reuptaken, so there will be lots of dopamine left in that in those areas. So you will see that when, for example, animals take drug, there is a huge amount of dopamine concentration in a striatum. So this probably has a strong effect on the behavioral effects that we will see. So this is not only for cocaine, so it is shown that many other drugs also have, at the end, they result in extra amount of dopamine in the nucleus accumbens, in striatum. So this is showing you the ventral tegmental area, this is small region, and then this is nucleus accumbens. So as I told you, cocaine and other psychostimulants block dopamine transporters. Other drugs like nicotine, ethanol, and morphine and other drugs, through different pathways, through different mechanisms, they at the end result in extra amount of dopamine. So this will be one of the major neurobiological findings about addiction that is common among addictive drugs that we'll try to somehow capture in the computational modeling of addiction. A second effect of drug that is again common among different drugs of abuse is the fact that these are the in human subjects, the level of dopamine transporters, dopamine receptors, dopamine D2 receptors in a striatum, which means these receptors. So as you see, so in all these cases there is a high level of dopamine receptor, but when you look at addicted subjects who has used different sorts of drugs for a very long time, you will see that for all of those different drugs, the level of dopamine receptor is significantly decreased. So this is a second effect of drug that is again common among all other drugs. So there are lots of other effects that are specific to drugs and or maybe common. So these are two two of the main ones that in this simplified version of understanding addiction I want to share with you. And then we'll try to build some models on the basis of these two effects: increased dopamine level and decreased dopamine receptors. So I'm going to very briefly talk about these two class of models, about models that are based on homeostatic regulation and models that are based on reinforcement learning. And then in the remaining time, I will talk a little bit about how to unify those two approaches. And yeah, so let's start by homeostatic models. So the critical observation that we are interested to model is that if you put the animal in the cage I showed you, you will observe that at the very beginning of the, for example, 1 hour session, the animal presses the lever several times in a row at the very beginning. So you see this thick line at the beginning. It means several lever presses. And then there is a pause for a while, the animal doesn't press. And then with a roughly regular rate, the animal presses every couple of seconds in order to get cocaine intravenously. This is one observation. Another observation is that if you increase the unit dose of cocaine that the animal receives upon every lever press, you'll see that the higher the dose is, the lower the rate of lever press is. So when one lever press results in a lot of cocaine, I press less often, maybe surprisingly. So in order to explain these two class of observations, the homeostatic models come up with a very simple idea, and that is individuals actively regulate the level of drug in their brain. So they have a certain level, that is their ideal level. They want to keep cocaine level at that level, or they don't want cocaine to drop below that certain level. So this level is sometimes called trigger point, sometimes called hedonic set point, or satiety threshold. So what is common among all these ideas is that there is a set point, I want to stay above the set point, and every time cocaine, the drug level goes below that, I go back. So in order to see how this theory explains those observations, so imagine that this is showing you the level of cocaine in the brain over time. When you inject a very small dose of cocaine, cocaine increases in very small amount and then goes back to zero. If you increase the dose, then there is a higher increase and then higher and higher for higher doses of cocaine. So you can simply model that with a very simple pharmacodynamical model that explains, that captures cocaine level in the striatum. And then we also know that by increasing cocaine level, dopamine level also increases, as I showed you, for example, since cocaine blocks dopamine transporters. So what these guys assume is that there is a certain variable in the brain which is called brain reward threshold. So it doesn't matter exactly what that variable is, whether it is brain reward threshold or something else. What they claim is that when dopamine increases in the brain, that variable decreases, for example, reward threshold. So, for example, if you receive a very high dose of cocaine, resulting in high amount of dopamine in the brain, then that variable significantly reduces in the brain. And this is, for example, that hypothetical set point level. So, and the objective of the animal is to keep that variable below the set point. As long as the variable is above the set point, you will keep pressing in order to go below the set point. So how will this simple theory explain those results? So let's say that we are going to look over time at that certain variable, reward threshold. So at the beginning we are here, and let's say this dotted line is the set point. So you first press the lever several times in order to reach below the set point. So you press and press and press, but you press the lever more than what is necessary in order to go below the set point. Why? Because when I press the lever, the effect of cocaine has not totally arrived in my brain, so I think that I'm still
above the set point, so I keep pressing, and when the effect comes, I have some extra amount of cocaine, so probably I will downshoot the set point. And then when you see that, okay, so I have arrived below the set point, so you don't press anymore, so that you don't have motivation because you're already below the set point. And when you again overshoot the set point, then you start pressing the lever with a certain, with a very regular rate in order to stay below the set point.
So this shows that how this simple idea can explain those experimental results I showed you at the beginning, that there is a loading effect of cocaine followed by a pause effect, pause period, and then a regular rate of pressing the lever.
Another thing that this model can explain very simply is the effect of changing the unit dose. For example, if you use high unit dose versus low unit dose, obviously if the objective is to stay below the set point, when the unit dose is smaller, you have to press faster, because every time you press, very quickly afterward, cocaine level will decrease back to the undesirable level, so you have to press the lever again. So this will also explain those behavioral results I showed you, that the dose response curve has a decreasing form. So this is the first class of model. The second class of models are the reinforcement, are based on reinforcement learning model that you probably know very well. So in the reinforcement learning model, you have an environment and an organism that interact. So at each point of time, the organism observes its states in the environment. For example, I observe that I'm standing in this room. And then based on that state, I have several actions to do. I look at what is the value of every action given my previous experiences in this room. And depending on those values, I choose one of the actions, probably the one that is the best. So when I do that action, as a result of doing that, for example, as a result of drinking this water, I get some rewarding effects from the environment. And based on those rewards, I compare what was my expectation before doing that action and what I really received in practice. So the difference between those is how much error I had in predicting the value. I use that prediction error in order to update my value so that next time I'll make a better decision to maximize reward. As I showed you, as I told you before, it has been shown by Peter and Schultz that dopamine neurons, phasic activity of dopamine neurons, is encoding this prediction error signal in the brain. So if we put this story to the story that I told you about the fact that drugs of abuse increase dopamine level, then the conclusion is very simple. So when I do a certain action that results in increased level of dopamine, then it's like that I always have some prediction error signal. So every time I take a certain drug, even if I have experienced it many times before, because they increase dopamine level, I believe that I'm still making some errors in predicting their value, so I should still increase their value. As a result, the estimated value of a drug-seeking action increases unboundedly every time that I take. So, it's obvious how it can explain, for example, compulsivity. When the rewarding value you attribute to drug increases unboundedly, then even a very big punishment that is paired with it will have no effect on it. So it has a very high value. So this is a second approach for explaining addiction that explains some other aspects of addiction that the first aspect doesn't. So these are both of these approaches to addiction are partially correct and very informative. But there might be the possibility of unifying them together. So, as I told you, in the reinforcement learning model, we assume that the feedback you get from the environment is the reward. But the fact is that
when I drink this water, I just get some certain outcome from the environment. And it's up to me to interpret with this machinery whether that certain outcome was rewarding or punishing to me, depending on my internal state, whether I'm thirsty or not. So I don't really get reward. I get just some outcome. So the way we can interpret whether a certain outcome is rewarding or not is through this mechanism. Let's say that, for example, in this two-dimensional space, I'm only looking at two physiological variables in my body, glucose level and temperature. It could be water or anything. And H shows my current level of glucose and my current temperature. And this happy point is my desired state. I want my glucose level and temperature to be here, as close as possible to this point. This is the homeostatic regulation idea. So when I eat a chocolate and my glucose level increases from this point to this point, then I get closer to the set point. So this shows how my distance from the set point increases as a result of this action. So when my distance from the set point increases, then I attribute some rewarding value to that certain action. So this is how the homeostatic reinforcement learning model defines reward, the reward that is then used by the same mechanism, reward learning mechanism, for making better predictions in the future. So this one thing that this model shows is that if you use such mechanism, then you're not only obtaining reward, but you're also trying to minimize your deviation from this set point. So let's see how this model can capture some aspects of addiction we talked earlier. So for example, this the fact that I told you that if animals have only 1 hour access to cocaine, they don't escalate, but if they have 6 hour access to cocaine per day, their lever press escalates over time. So this shows only number of presses during the first hour. So the first hour for the short access animals, it's stable. For the long access animal, it increases. So how we model that is that we say that, okay, so we have this environment, the animal presses a lever and then receives cocaine. And every time you receive cocaine, the level of cocaine increases like this in the brain. It first increases and then it goes back over time to zero. And these effects can accumulate over time if you press the lever several times. So cocaine increases, you press it again, it comes back, but before coming back to zero, you press the lever again, it goes high again. And then these effects accumulate over time until you reach your desired set point. And then there is a certain regulated variable in the brain, you can call it again reward threshold, that has a certain ideal level. So every time you take cocaine, as a result of the change in the level of cocaine, you get closer or further from the set point, and your ideal is to, and every time you get closer to the set point, there is a certain, it has some rewarding value, which will update your predictions so that it will increase the rewarding value of pressing the lever in order to get close to the set point. So this is the effect of cocaine on increasing, for example, dopamine level and so increasing brain reward threshold. So this is the acute effect of cocaine. But we know that cocaine also has another effect, which is, for example, decreasing dopamine receptor availability. So you could argue that as a result of reduction in the dopamine receptor availability, the same amount of dopamine in the brain, dopamine molecules in the brain, cannot have the same effect that it had before. So it means that it's equivalent to saying that your set point is going further and further. So your expectation goes higher and higher because dopamine receptors are lower than before. So in order to have the same effect on the downstream circuits, you will need a higher level of dopamine, a higher level of cocaine in order to reach that set point. So these are actually those two neurobiological facts that we talked about at the beginning, that cocaine regulates that reward threshold, for example, and chronic cocaine affects the position of the set point. So I don't have much time to go through the results that this model can explain. I'll show you only some of the basic
experimental animal models that the model explained.
So let's say that these are our two groups of animals. The short axis animals, at the first, they have their homeostatic set point is at 100, and it remains at 100 over time. But for long axis animals, let me show it here. Yeah, for long axis animals, so the white area is during the time that the animal has access to cocaine. The gray area is the rest of the day when the animal doesn't have access. So the set point level in the long axis animals increase over time, but it doesn't. The animal doesn't have enough time over the rest of the day, which is 18 hours, to recover the set point to its initial state. But for the short axis animals, it recovers completely because it has increased very mildly. So in the long axis animals, the set point increases over days. And if you look at several days, you will see that the set point level has increased significantly to an upper bound. As a result of that, surprising that so the short axis animals they want to stay at this level, their cocaine level want to reach this level from zero, but for long axis animals they want to reach this escalated level, so they obviously have to press the lever much more than long axis animals, and this is over the 6 hours lever press over 6 hours versus lever press over 1 hour. So you can see that this can explain the experimental results that are shown under similar experimental situations. Another thing that you can argue is that as I told you, short axis animals want to reach this low level of cocaine of reward threshold, but long axis animals want to reach a higher level, which is 200 escalated level. So you'll see that if I only look at the first 10 minutes, at the very beginning of the every day, the animal has to press the lever several times in order to reach the set point. They have to start from zero and reach the set point. So in the first 10 minutes, they have to press the lever much more than later. After they have reached the set point, they need a regular rate of lever press in order to keep the set point at that level. But for the long axis animals, in the very first day, the long axis animal has the same set point. So they will show the same pattern as you observed here on the first day. It doesn't make any difference. But after 25 days, when the set point level has escalated for long axis animals, at the beginning they have to press much more in order to get to this escalated level, and after we reach there, they have to still press with a higher rate in order to keep the set point at that escalated level. So you expect to observe these two behavioral effects in animals, which is exactly what you see if you look at the 10-minute bins in those two groups of animals. This should be the last thing I explain. So another thing is the effect of dose. If I increase a unit dose of drug, what happens is that when the dose is small, you have to press much more in order to get to stay at the set point. When the dose is bigger, you will need less lever press. So you will see that the number of lever presses decreases as a function of unit dose. But so the number of lever presses decreases, but the total amount of cocaine consumed doesn't matter on the dose. If you have smaller dose, you will press much faster, and if you have bigger dose, you will press much slower, but at the end, the total amount of cocaine consumption is not different among different doses, but is higher for long axis as compared to short axis animals. So this can also be explained. This can also is also shown in experimental results. So long story short, this unified framework tries to look at both pharmacological effects, the dose effects of drug,
through how it affects the homeostatic system, and also look at its rewarding effects. For example, obviously, when you're far from the set point, you have more desire to get to the set point because you're too far from your ideal point, so you attribute higher rewarding value to drugs. So those guys who are probably addicted, they are willing to sacrifice some other rewarding things, or they're willing to accept some punishment, some costs, in order to reach, to get closer to that very far set point. So as a conclusion, as I said, so it was a very simplified picture of addiction, and the conclusion is also a very simplified view of addiction. So I showed you that if we assume that firstly dopamine plays a central role in that homeostatic regulation system, homeostatic reinforcement learning system, and also assuming that cocaine hijacks this dopamine signaling both chronically and over short periods of time, then this simplified model can explain a very simplified version of addiction, which means that it doesn't take into account individual differences, nor it takes into account differences between different drugs of abuse. So there are lots of things that should be done in order to capture, to have a better view, more complicated version of addiction. So some of them Shosi is going to talk about.
Okay, thank you, Mehdi, for a very nice and very clear illustration of a very solid model of addiction, at least based on some animal data. And before I start, actually, I just want to say a brief summary that many of you probably come to the course hoping that you might be able to find a reliable mechanism or even treatment options based on these computational psychiatry methods. But up to this point, many of you probably have already felt either bored or distrusting or frustrated, since we keep mentioning these keywords like dopamine, precision, or prediction errors. So just look at the title of my talk. You might be thinking, probably Mehdi and I didn't rehearse that well, that we might be counter-arguing with each other. The truth is, I'm not trying to do that, first of all. And secondly, the purpose is really to cheer everyone up and to show you that things are not that bad, that we have some very initial insight into how computational methods might provide possibilities into intervention. So today I'm going to talk about what's happening beyond the dopamine system. Okay. Oops. All right. So still, I need to talk about dopamine first. So very different from other mental disorders, there have been actually decades of research and very high-quality research in addiction. And this one-slide summary is a nice illustration of the potential neural candidates and the potential cognitive or behavioral phenotypes that are very nicely decomposed by Everett and Trevor Robbins. So here we see a lot of familiar concepts, right? Like maybe habitual learning, associations, Pavlovian instrumental transition. And these processes have been very nicely matched to very specified neural circuits. And of course, beyond those, we can see that there are also specific neural equipment for, let's say, prefrontal cortex for control, top-down control or executive control, as well as some other more feeling aspects of addiction, such as craving or interceptive aspects. However, this very recent review paper just caught my attention, actually, I think 1 or 2 weeks ago, authored by David Nutt and colleagues. So here they did a brief synthesis of PET, specifically PET studies of different drugs. So, okay. Okay, that spoiled it. This slide is supposed to come first. Okay, pretend you didn't read the legends. Anyhow, I should explain that each color represents a different drug, right? Okay, I'll just go back. the measurement here is sort of a D2, D3 PET binding. So a decreased number here means increased synaptic dopamine level. And we can see that, first of all, PET studies are very expensive to do, right? So secondly, for certain drugs, these results are really consistent, especially for amphetamine. So this is intravenous amphetamine, and this is oral amphetamine. So we can see that very consistent with each other, and also the effect size seems to be very big. When we go to nicotine, we see, okay, still pretty good, although there is one study that found the opposite effect. And alcohol, pretty good, although there are only two studies. And when you move to other drugs like ketamine or THC, which is the main ingredient for marijuana, and morphine, you can see that effect size is very small and there's a lot of heterogeneity among these findings, right? So, and not to really, make any definitive conclusions yet, but at least from these studies, it seems like the dopamine story does not account at least for all addictive drugs. Okay. So, actually, maybe back 10, 12 years ago, Nora Volkov, who is the head of National Institute of Drug Abuse, has already done this study in cocaine users to look at cognitive factors that goes beyond striatal dopamine. So here it's still a PET study. What they did is they used this drug that Tobias actually just mentioned, methylphenidate. In cocaine users, this drug has been reported to generate very similar subjective feelings as cocaine. And later on, there is a similar study done and directly using cocaine in cocaine users. And what they did here is they tell the subject that they're going to receive the drug. The drug could be either a real drug or a placebo. And the expectation is that you're going to receive an active drug or placebo. And across these two studies, what they found is compared to unexpected drug delivery, that means you're told you'll be receiving a placebo, but actually you received an active drug. That expected drug delivery seemed to enhance neuroactivity in several regions. Such as this striatum region here, and also the medial prefrontal cortex. So just to emphasize that one thing to notice, one common feature of these two studies is that belief is known and experimentally controlled. Okay. And I should mention that there is a whole field or whole industry of placebo effect studies, right? I just want to point out the difference, because in most placebo studies, in this example, one of the most highly cited placebo study by Helen Mayberg in depressed patients, showing that placebo treatments and fluorexin, which is an antidepressant treatment, seem to recover these neuroactivities to very similar extent and in very similar neural substrates like the cingulate. However, what is different in the placebo effect is that belief is usually unknown, right? So the subjects usually do not know. That's also how neuropharmacological studies are conducted. So when you give the drug, participants, they do not know whether it's an active drug or a placebo. So why do we want to study beliefs? I think this answer is very clear. And also, this has been mentioned in some previous studies. We know cognitive therapy or CBT-type therapies have been one of the main therapies or treatment options for many psychiatric disorders, including substance abuse. And I would argue that the how is really what's missing. I think we as researchers don't know how these cognitive inputs can actually alter drug effects. And this is especially important for clinicians, I assume, because when you prescribe a certain drug to a patient, you would like to know how this drug or how this CBT treatment works. Okay, so in this very simple study, we use nicotine addiction as a test case to study belief drug interaction. So again, the hypothesis is that, let's say we have a belief on state. Okay, think of this as a, let's say, a dopamine on or DBS on state, where the brain is active, and you'll see nicotine will bind to these nicotinic acetylcholine receptors, which further stimulates dopamine release in the ventral striatum. And the question is whether we can turn off these beliefs and observe subsequent neural activity changes. So the way we did it is we presented to the subjects these identical cigarettes. They're told this cigarette either has nicotine or has no nicotine. However, half of the times the cigarette actually had nicotine, and half of the times the cigarette has no nicotine. So it's a 2x2, if you want to call it, 2x2 crossover design. So just to remind you again here, our region of interest is this mesolimbic dopamine system, and there is a very recent study by Colin Cameron and Reed Montague showing that, you know, these both signals in the ventral striatum very nicely tracks the price of a stock market. So we use a very similar stock market task in which the subject observe this graph, which is actually based on the real stock market. So first of all, they observe a history of the market, and then what they need to do is to make a bet about how much they want to invest on each trial. So the bar here represents the percentage of the investment. And on the left, you see the running total. So that is the current portfolio of the subject, right? And on the right, you see the loss or the win of the immediate trial. So in this case, the subject had just lost a very substantial amount of money. And this task has been used in several previous studies from the Montague lab. So here we just look at two very simple signals. There are many other parameters you can extract, but since we're interested still in the dopamine system, we look at two specific signals that are known to guide value-based decision-making. One is just the fractional market return, so the value signal, R, and the other one is a prediction error signal, very typical, based on a temporal difference model. Basically what you actually get versus what you predict you would get. So here's the procedure. So again, just to repeat the design, it's a placebo-controlled and double-blind design. We have instructed belief, so either told no nicotine or told nicotine. And the cigarette either had no nicotine, which is, this is the minimal amount we can get to, and with actual nicotine, right? This is a normal level. In addition to that, we also controlled or included additional factor, which is interceptive or satiety state. This is between subjects. So we had one group of subjects that come deprived, meaning that they have to stay away from smoking from at least the midnight before the scanning session. And another group that is non-deprived, so they can smoke freely. And we confirmed that by measuring an exhaled carbon monoxide level upon their arrival to the lab. So you can see that the deprived group showed much less CO level than the non-deprived group. So I said that. And then we give them the belief and also let them smoke a cigarette. Okay, and then we throw them into the MR scanner to do this stock market task. And lastly, after they come out of the scanner, we measure their craving and a bunch of other subjective measures again, and as well as CO level. Okay, so first of all, when the subjects, we look at non-deprived, normal smokers. So when subjects were told nicotine and smoke nicotine, they sort of demonstrate this pretty normal learning pattern, which means that the previous values seem to guide your choice behavior on the next trial. And this is paralleled by a significant ventral striatum activation related to value. Okay, what happened when they were told no nicotine, yet still smoke nicotine was a very shocking result to us at the moment, at the time. Because in both conditions, nicotine level is controlled as a constant. However, the subjects can significantly reduce their learning behavior and also striatum activation just based on one simple belief, and it's an instructed belief of told no nicotine. And we further confirmed that with a secondary analysis. So we look at this second parameter, the TD signal. And similarly, we found sort of a normal learning pattern in the told nicotine condition. And same here, you see still pretty robust ventral striatum activation. And yet again, when subjects were told no nicotine and smoke nicotine, both behavioral and neural signals of learning seem to be largely reduced. So far everything is in non-deprived smokers, right? So I'm sure many people, maybe some of you smoke and you have some friends who smoke. So when they can smoke on a continuous basis, they act like normal people, right? And what happens when you deprive them? Okay, so we replicate the whole analysis on the second cohort again. Nothing. All right. So, so there was no change in either the behavior or the neural learning signal. And this is true for the value signal and as well as for the prediction error signal. However, this is a sort of a second paper we're working on now. It's to dig deeper. Remember that I showed you we did measure craving before and after the manipulation. So interestingly, in this deprived cohort, we did find a very significant effect on craving. Here I should explain that this score is the difference between the two measurements of craving. So if it's a negative, it means that you feel less craving after smoking and after the experiment. In other words, you feel more satisfied, right? There's this huge relief and satisfaction brought about by smoking a cigarette. And yet again, this is gone. When you think there is no nicotine, yet smoked a nicotine cigarette. So I didn't plot here, but this one is significantly different from zero. And this blue bar here is non-significant. So So here's my favorite region again. Remember I showed you that there was no difference in the ventral striatum activation. But in this particular deprived cohort, we actually found very strong insular activation related to the value signal and also the TD signal. Again, in the toed nicotine and smoked nicotine condition, you see that this insular activation is on. And when they think there is no nicotine but actually smoke nicotine, this insular activation is off. So just to zoom in a little bit about what this insular activation really means. So Becky already told you briefly about in a very nice way that how insular can serve as an interceptive cortex. And here I just want to repeat and sort of shamelessly present some of my previous work again. So this is really actually what got me into this decision-making field, is we know I'm definitely not the first one to find these insular signals in decision-making tasks. So I guess one of the most cited papers is from Prushov and colleagues, where they found insular activation related to risk, right? And after that, I think there's a whole area looking into how the insular is involved in certain aspects of decision-making. But actually, just outside of this area, there is a huge amount of literature looking at how stuff like both observed or empathetic feelings and your actual own feelings can activate the insula. And in a very cognitive task, we also found that insular activation linearly increases as information entropy increases. And in some of the recent work we did, actually with my previous lab, we found that autonomic arousal seems to have a very high correlation with insular activity. So aside from these, I want to present to you some really important, what you might want to call causal evidence from other labs. So this is a study where they delivered electrical stimulation of the insular cortex. And here is a flat map of the insula. And the stimulation sites are sort of more posterior to middle. And so they did this in the monkeys. When the monkey is, you know, eating some snack that they really like. But once they start to stimulate the insula, what happens is that the monkey displays a very strong sort of disgust response. So this is one piece of evidence. And in relation to addiction, there have been both rodent and human evidence suggesting that lesion to the insular cortex seem to reduce craving and also drug-seeking behavior. And in both cases, it's nicotine, right? Okay, so I think I'll probably skip this one, but just to say that we think, going back to Mahdi's model, that interception and homeostasis is an integral part of decision-making system. Just think about all the literature where, especially in rodents, where rewards or value is always realized through either juice or food palate. I think that's already some evidence suggesting by default decision-making involves, to a large extent, your regulation of the homeostasis and interceptive state. Okay, so just a quick discussion. We discussed you know, these various types of computational models that can help us understand better addiction, and especially in terms of homeostasis regulation and reinforcement learning. And what I talked to you about is that although there are these some in some way hardwired processes going on, we as humans are not just a pack of neurons or cells walking around. And I think that at least we show instructed beliefs can have a very significant effect on these what people traditionally consider as very sort of solid or hardwired processes. And specifically, we show that learning and craving can be sort of modulated depending on the satiety state or interceptive state of the subject. So this really opens a whole window of possibilities, because we know that we have these very nice models, right? We know exactly which parameters we're going after. So if we can already change learning and can change these specific craving aspects, I'm sure that there might be potentials for developing intervention for at least addiction. And lastly, I think this question might go beyond addiction. If we think in the broader picture of belief-drug interaction, I think the same problem applies to many areas of psychiatric research, such as, you know, depression, anxiety, ADHD, OCD. Actually, there have been some clinical trials already showing how much the patient trusts or believes the clinician can have a dramatic impact on a treatment outcome, and actually in a parametric fashion. Okay, so lastly, my acknowledgements, and just want to say special thanks to Terry, and of course, Reed Montague. These studies were done actually in Texas, in Baylor School of Baylor College of Medicine, and there was a whole team of, you know, people really working behind this. And since, imagine, it was about 50 subjects that each counts four times, so it was a total of about 200 scans. Although it seems a little bit small to the Montague standard. And lastly, also, my collaborators here at UCL, Tom Fitzgerald and Carl Friston, for their, you know, discussion and guidance on this interceptive inference model, and Mehdi and Peter Diane for all these you know, nice discussions on the homeostasis reinforcement learning model. And also, these research were funded by both the NIH and Wellcome Trust. And thank you all for your attention.
Thanks very much, both of you. Questions for Mehdi and Jazzy?
I thought, maybe just me, but I thought the two-dimensional representation of reward spaces was really striking. An interesting way of thinking about reward learning. So I guess what it suggests is incentive salience to performance is gradient descent down that slope that you